Welcome to How I Raised It, the podcast that goes behind the scenes with entrepreneurs who've raised capital. We uncover the tips, tricks, and techniques they use to get investors to write a check. Strap in and turn it up.
Hi, welcome to another episode of How I Raised It, produced by Foundersuite.com. Today I have Jonathan Poulter of Pawn Guru coming to us from Detroit. How's your day going, Jonathan?
Fantastic, Nathan. Thank you for having me.
My pleasure. So what is Pawn Guru, P-A-W-N, Pawn Guru?
So Pawn Guru, in the simplest way to say it, is sort of the price line or the orbits for the pawn shop industry. So there are 30 million consumers that use a pawn shop every year to pawn, sell, and buy items. Up until the creation of our platform, they would have to physically go from shop to shop to find the exact item they're looking to buy or to get the best price on the item they're trying to sell or get a pawn loan on. With the creation of Pawn Guru, we've moved that process all online. So they can now go to our platform, submit the item they want to pawn, sell, or buy, put some information down, some photos, list the zip code, and based on that zip code, we match them up with shops that are interested in their item, who make them offers, send them messages, and they're able to sort of do everything except get their cash before they walk in that store. But they know who they're going to, approximately how much they're going to get paid, and any other details that they would want to know before walking in to close the transaction.
Is it a little bit analogous to those firms that sprouted up that would take your stuff out of your garage and sell it on eBay for you? I mean, you're kind of facilitating a process. Is that correct?
I suppose in some ways, in terms of used goods, it's similar to that. However, in the example you just gave, they are not actually the marketplace. They are the packaging companies. So they're competing more with the moving companies, et cetera, than they are with us. A simple way to say it is really eBay. For a unique consumer base with a unique set of merchants and retail merchants on the other side.
And for people not familiar, what is a pawn shop? Your people bring in items. Do they get a loan on that item? Or what is a pawn shop?
That's a great question. And I know especially when we have chatted with folks on the East Coast and the West Coast in the past and VCs, it is so far removed from many demographics in America that a lot of them don't even know what a pawn loan is. So the pawn industry is from the oldest industries ever in the world. In fact, there's some story about a king, I forgot if it's England or France, who actually had to pawn his jewels in order to fight a war. And I think he lost. He probably lost because he didn't have Pawn Guru and wasn't able to get enough money for them. That's a whole separate conversation. The point is, it goes back hundreds and thousands of years. And the idea that people give an item as collateral in exchange for cash has been around forever. And that's really what a pawn loan is. I have an item, a Rolex, an Xbox, a TV, a rare painting, or a signed Muhammad Ali boxing glove. And I'm in need of quick cash. I can take it to the pawn shop, and in 20 minutes, based on the value of the item, the pawn shop will give me a particular dollar amount. He gets to hold on to that Rolex in a safe and secure place. That's all governed by state and city and federal laws. For a certain period of time, he's able to charge you interest. And again, that's governed by multiple laws. And then when you come in contact with your cash, you are able to swap that item out and get your item back. And the industry not only services what a lot of people think are folks who fall into the underbanked and unbanked category that need access to quick cash, but actually a growing number of wealthier folks that might be asset rich and liquid poor are using pawn shops as a quick way to close a real estate deal. And these folks do make loans of $100,000, $200,000. And to think that you're trying to get a real estate deal closed and you need to come up with $50,000 cash for closing tomorrow, well, if you can give up your Ferrari for 2 weeks, you can get a loan. And there's certainly an element of that. Obviously, the majority of it is still the everyday consumer that's looking to make ends meet.
Interesting. Fascinating. So is your customer the pawn shops themselves or the consumers looking for the loan?
Great question. You know, as a dual-sided marketplace, we obviously have a responsibility to both sides of it, and we're cognizant of that. That being said, I think the pawn shops themselves would agree that providing a valuable service to the consumer should be our number one concern, because that not only benefits our platform, but frankly, it benefits the pawn shops, because they're now able to get the traffic they otherwise would have not gotten. So at the end of the day, Pawn Guru's goal and our mission statement, so to speak, is as simple as knowledge is power. And by providing consumers with as much information as we can on this particular transaction, that generally happens at a time of need. You know, there's usually some chaotic or stressful event in their life that's forcing them to lift their 60-inch TV and bring it across town to get some cash. And we want to be there to provide them with that information, that knowledge, that negotiating power, to ease the process a little bit. It's not a contradiction to still providing value to the pawn shops. But at the end of the day, it's the consumers that we want to really guarantee have a great experience. And just one extra point on that, a lot of folks are convinced that, notice that I didn't say getting them the highest offer. I said knowledge, because there's a lot of factors that go into how they decide to, or who they decide to close a deal with. And very often it's a distance we find. So you might have a higher offer from a pawn shop that's an extra 3 miles away, but for whatever reason, you can't make it there. So we really focus on providing them knowledge, ratings of the pawn shop, distance of the pawn shop, hours of the pawn shop, pricing, you know, and all these other factors, and allow them to choose what's the most convenient for them.
Last question, then I want to talk about fundraising, which is the thrust of this show. But how did you come up with this idea? Were you, did you run a pawn shop? Were you
industry? I get that question all the time. I actually started out 20 years ago as an ordained rabbi, believe it or not. I decided to bring God into other industries. At least I'm attempting to. I've been in the alternative investment business for many years. I have other businesses that I'm involved with. And being in them, I got into, I got introduced to the various different asset classes that service the unbanked and underbanked consumer. And I became very intrigued with that. And I felt that there was a not only a lucrative opportunity, but there was a fun and, I hate to use the word, disruptive opportunity, but I'll use it anyways, and to really change an industry and make an impact and have fun while we're doing it. So as we were, my partner and I, my original co-founder and I, David Stiebel, were sitting about 3 years ago in the office after having worked in a few other lines relating to this, related to this consumer base. And basically we just took, I took several items from my wife's jewelry box without telling her. And I went up and down the famous 8 Mile in Detroit and I tried to pawn the items, and the price difference was 500%. So I came back to our office. We actually put a landing page up in 15 minutes and started flooding ourselves with AdWords leads in Atlanta, and the leads came in about a half hour later, and my partner and I would manually call the pawn shops to see what they would give on items. And that was our iteration one, and we've since grown to millions of monthly visits that we've, thank God, built 100% organically. You can type in any word on the internet and follow it with the word pawn, pre or post, and we show up. And that's really, you know, we jumped on it, and we have about 4,000 pawn shops right now around the country that are part of our network.
Wow.
Which make up about 25% of the industry, 25-30% of the industry. We are pre-revenue still. We've been focused only on creating liquidity. But now we're at a point that part of this recent round is to really, you know, finalize those remaining outstanding pieces, which leads us to your fundraising questions.
Okay, so fundraising questions, but one last thing. Well, I'm assuming you didn't pawn your wife's jewels or you probably would be divorced. But is bringing this transparency kind of, you know, I think the pawn industry, the payday loans, this whole space serving this underbank gets a pretty bad rap. Are you bringing transparency? Or are you, I don't want to say cleaning up this industry a little bit, but are you, you know, improving improving the lives?
That's a great question. That's a great question. I will answer your previous question, though, on my wife's diamond ring. I actually managed to find her a much nicer one.
Oh, there we go.
Swapped it out. But be that as it may, we've been very blessed with our relationships that we've been able to cultivate across the country. Although we're a Detroit-based startup, we realized that we were a little behind the eight ball and focused on building quality relationships, including a relationship with the accelerator Mucker Capital that's been tremendous. You know, being blessed with that, we got access to a host of high-profile people. And I remember talking with somebody at Google that was intrigued with what we were doing, but they said that they were more focused on figuring out how to solve poverty. And my response to that was, I know that for the last several thousand years, people have been trying to solve poverty, and I'm sure one day you will. But until then, these are the services that are being used by that demographic. So we'll build out the service, and I suppose when you folks figure out how to solve poverty, you may just look down. So at the end of the day, there's no question that there are some negative view of them. I think, frankly, part of that might be relating to some of the, you know, media or TV shows or news articles out there that people see. And generally, news succeeds when it's more negative than positive. So certainly that's been a piece of it. At the end of the day, yes, we're basically taking a consumer base that's already using this, and we're empowering them. We are putting the negotiations back in their lap.
Okay, great. Let's talk about fundraising. It's a fascinating space, fascinating business model. But let's talk about fundraising. So you guys have raised a friends and family, a seed round, and a Series A. Is that correct?
Yep.
How much in total have you raised?
Right around $4
million. Great. So the friends and family, I assume you were pretty much conceptual stage. You put up these landing pages, bought the keywords.
We didn't even have the money to buy the napkin to write the plan on when we put the friends and family route. So yes, that was all the way at the beginning. Correct.
And then your next step was the seed round and the accelerator Mucker Capital, which I've been, it's funny. A lot of roads seem to lead to Mucker. I think you're about the fourth or fifth interview I've done that's someone that's been through Mucker. So how did you end up with Mucker?
We have some good friends out west that have embraced us and were early angel investors, specifically the team at Swagbucks, which is a fairly prominent LA-based startup. Well, they're beyond startup at this point. And they had relationships with Mucker, and they made the introduction, and we were able to convince them to join us.
So did you go through their accelerator program, or were they just investors in the note?
No, we went through their accelerator program, but Mucker's accelerator program is quite different than others, and that was one of the reasons that we were intrigued by it. You know, at the end of the day, we are a Detroit-based company. We felt there were advantages to staying here. You know, we have when I say Detroit, I'm talking Detroit, Ann Arbor. They're about 30 minutes from each other. The ability to bring on engineers, obviously the cost of living, the competitive nature, and frankly, we are all homeborn Michiganders, so we weren't planning on picking ourselves up and leaving. But Mucker allows you to sort of use their services as you see fit, and they sort of have a flexible, ongoing cohort, and that's how we participated.
Okay. All right. Let's talk about that note. So was that angels or if PitchBook is correct, I see names like Impact America Fund. How did you raise that note?
It was a combination of angels and And yeah, I guess angels and VCs, and the two primary VCs besides Mucker were Invest Detroit, a local-based VC, and Impact America, based out of Oakland.
Are these traditional VCs, or are they just from the names? They sound more maybe like an economic development group, or tell me about these.
So Invest Detroit is it's certainly related to the economic development of Southeast Michigan, but other than that, they function and act as a full-fledged VC. So you go through the same process. The only limitation is you need to be based in Southeast Michigan. Gotcha. And Impact America is similar. They're a wonderful organization. The one who runs it is Keisha Cash. She's got a fascinating story, but they are focused on impact investing. So Keisha's story actually starts out, I believe, in South Carolina, where her dad actually used pawn shops to make ends meet.
Oh, really?
And, so she lived it and saw it, and she was, you know, she knew exactly what we were building and got the value, and she's been a great asset ever since.
Did you only talk to, or apart from Mucker, which is in Los Angeles, did you only talk to Detroit area investors? And what's the funding scene like in Detroit? I don't know too much about it.
Great question. So my rule of thumb is I will talk to anybody who's willing to listen. And I encourage all funders that review this to keep that in mind. I know initially, myself included, we're a little hesitant. We're afraid people are going to steal their ideas and all that. I assume less than 1% of the population is going to focus on executing and stealing your ideas. So get out there and talk. And I certainly did a whole lot of that to anybody who's willing to listen. Again, going back to our network, we were blessed where we did have tentacles across the country, and we had VCs from across the country that we were able to introduce our product to and get on the phone with. Some obviously went through with meetings. At the end of the day, though, to be fair and honest, being out of the East or West Coast was incredibly challenging. But for us, it was slightly more challenging, going back to what you said earlier, which was the word pawn just scared them, and it scared them more because they didn't understand it. They weren't able to live it and appreciate it. And getting them over that hump was a challenge. So while we spoke to dozens and, you know, got down the road various different degrees, at the end of the day, I think it's important for founders to really be honest with themselves. And, you know, you got to know where you stand. You got to know the product that you have and just stick with it. I remember early on, and I'm sure we all do this, so I can come clean now, but you ultimately tweak your pitch based on the VC you're talking to try and pretty it up. And, you know, we would come out of VC meetings, and in our mind, our business model completely changed because, you know, this VC was more interested in this. And frankly, when we sort of accepted who we are and what we are and stuck with that, we were able to do a much better job and go out and actually target the types of investors that would, you know, be interested in this product.
No, I think that's good advice. I totally know what you're talking about, the temptation to pivot and change your business model after every VC meeting. How did you build a target list of investors that would, you know, where this story would resonate? Because it is a little bit outside the typical sandbox.
I combed VCs high and low, and I looked for one of two things. Well, a few things. Number one is I obviously looked for seed rounds. Number two is I looked for investors that either had made a play in the used goods market. So anybody that appreciated buying and selling that was a used item. Number two is anybody that was excited about marketplaces. Mm-hmm. Or number three, anybody that was excited about OfferUp. NerdWallet, for example, unbanked and underbanked financial platforms. Basically I would look at folks that I mentioned OfferUp, folks that were interested in OfferUp. I would look at folks that were interested in NerdWallet and maybe folks that, you know, invested in companies that eBay ultimately purchased that may have had some element. And that pretty much includes every VC in the United States of America, actually, by the time When you shrink it down to seed round, you definitely, you know, limit your list. I would then go to Crunchbase, and then you realize they say they do seed, and you realize that the last time they did seed was right after the Vietnam War ended. So at that point, you can safely assume they probably don't do seed, although they say they do seed. And then I would just shrink it down from there. And then the next phase is finding out how you have access to them. Again, we did have a pretty broad-based relationship work. So that was, I wouldn't say easy, but it was easier than a typical Midwestern startup might find. And then we got on the phone and we went through the grind.
Yeah. How long did it take to raise money?
Well, the answer is that a founder and entrepreneur who's honest with you, certainly from outside of the East Coast or West Coast, will tell you you're always raising money.
Yeah.
Back prior to this call, I got off the phone with another VC that reached out to us, as is typical after you do a round. They always seem to show up like 30 minutes late after you need them.
After you raise. Sure.
That's the nature of life. So we were always fundraising. and frankly, being in Detroit, I mean, I would say that I have been fundraising, you know, on and off for the last 3 years since we started. You know, were there times that I took a little breather and didn't make it my core focus? Sure. But I never went a month without doing something relating to fundraising, whether it's fixing the pitch deck or updating our numbers or cultivating relationships. You're just on it all the time.
Yeah. Okay, this is good. So what advice would you give, you know, other Detroit-based or Midwestern-based founders who are raising money? You know, if you were giving yourself advice, your younger self advice, what advice would you give your younger self doing this all over again?
Several pieces. Number one is do not read TechCrunch or VentureBeat. Those stories rarely happen. And I say that obviously kiddingly, but my point is it's easy to read those articles and just feel completely rejected and wondering what you're doing wrong and whether or not your business is even viable. And the fact is that for every one of those, there's 100 of stories like us, and there's, you know, millions of other types. So yeah. Be very careful that the headlines you read there, and I know, again, when we started out, you know, that's the benchmark by which we measure ourselves, and it's easy to get down in the dumps. That's number one. Number two is realize that being out of the East Coast and the West Coast, you are going to be at a disadvantage. So even when, again, you're negotiating on valuations and terms, you know, at the end of the day, even if you do an analysis and you read the articles and there's a lot of VCs that sort of put out there their public records of the types of deals they do, remember that's going to be heavily skewed for, you know, Silicon Valley, which is not how things function in the rest of the country. The third element is, and that's something that we're blessed with that we did, is, you know, up until this last raise, we really had about 1.5 million raised. And we built up our platform and our product, like I said, to 2 million unique visits a month and 3,000 pawn shops with $1.5 million. And we did that by doing things very lean. I find that very often, and this is obviously part of the lean methodology, but we certainly experienced it, like you're always waiting for that perfect moment, of course, to push something, to do something, to get on the phone, to start selling. There is no perfect moment. And just do it and run with it. And the amount of information you'll learn from getting out there will be worth it. Always be on the fundraising prowl. Talk to anyone who's willing to listen. Don't worry about people stealing your idea. Most companies, certainly at our level, are not going to have any sort of intellectual property. Don't waste any money on patents because nobody cares about them. You don't have the money to fight them anyways. Mm-hmm. And just, you know, at this point, you know, you're either going to have to show revenue, and obviously we are pre-revenue, but I think we did a good job at showing traction. And, you know, I think a lot of it is also building the team and who you surround yourself with. So make sure that the people you surround yourself with are going to be able to be as passionate. I mean, everybody on our team, certainly the leadership team, has given up a significant amount of equity or pay in other opportunities that they were pursuing. And what that did for us was it built a team that's just full of passion. And that comes across in a pitch meeting, and the investors see it and believe it. And the phrase that they invest in teams, not in products, is there's definitely a lot of truth to that.
Yeah, interesting. Is the entire team in Detroit, or are you guys spread
around?
Yeah,
we're all based around Metro Detroit. We actually have one employee that's out in your neck of the woods, but you're primarily here. And we're an Ann Arbor based startup, and we've benefited from the U of M relationship, and in fact, most of our employees, certainly on the engineering side, are all U of M alum.
Gotcha. How's the so actually two questions that are kind of interrelated. What's the startup scene looking like in Detroit these days, and will you stay in Detroit for future financings? Is there enough capital in Detroit to fund this?
Good question. So folks have to understand Detroit and Ann Arbor are about a half hour from each other. Mm-hmm. And in San Francisco, that's how long it takes just to get to lunch.
Yeah.
Really when you say Detroit, you're really looking at Southeast Michigan is really the point. The Detroit scene is there. I can't say it's absolutely booming. I mean, I think we're doing a great job and we're making headway. And I am a lifelong Detroiter going back to the 1930s. Hmm. So I was passionate and excited about the city as anybody, three generations here already. Certainly the Ann Arbor scene has had its fair share of successes. And I think, obviously that's a lot of where the young talent is. And, I suppose that we will, we have no plans of moving out of Detroit or moving out of Metro Detroit. Like I said, we're really more based out of Ann Arbor. There's no shortage of talent. There's no shortage of, really anything that we might need. In terms of, future raises, I think one thing that also is different for a Midwest company versus on the coasts is that on the coasts you can have a business model of your next goal is to get another round. I would recommend anybody outside of the coast to not have that goal. Now, it doesn't mean you're not going to get another round, but don't build your business model around it. So to your point, I think this is one of these questions. This fundraising round was planned with us assuming that at the end of this round, and when this money runs out, we will be cash flow positive. I'm not saying we're not going to raise another round, but at least we do it on our terms.
Yeah.
And if for whatever reason we can't, the environment's not the same. There's so many factors in the VC world is very finicky. The first people to get, dropped by the side are obviously those that are outside of the coasts. And the last people to let back in when there's an upswing are also going to be us. So we're using this funding to turn ourselves into a real business, not to get to another round.
Mm-hmm. Makes sense. Great. Well, any last, a bit of a tangent. I think I've read about Scott Cook's initiatives in Detroit, Southeast Michigan. Is the Intuit founder, isn't he putting a lot
I think you're talking about the Quicken.
Quicken, sorry.
Dan Gilbert, yes.
Is any of that paying off that you can see? Is it building a base?
Certainly, yes. In terms of the Detroit business scene and marketplace, things are absolutely booming here. As I joke, one of the nice things about hitting rock bottom is that there's only one place to go, and that's up. Certainly benefiting from it, but in reality, the amount of life and vitality that's been brought back to the city has been tremendous. And there's no question that Mr. Gilbert and his team are credited with a significant portion of that. Real estate is booming. There's apartments going up. There's young life moving back into the city and all the entertainment that comes along with it. Obviously, brand new arenas, and the list goes on. Unfortunately, we're not getting Amazon HQ2. But nonetheless, we still have a few other companies namely Ford and General Motors and Chrysler, that are able to support the city's growth. So, yes, the city as a whole has been absolutely on the upswing, and Mr. Gilbert is certainly a large portion of that.
Very good. All right. Any other tips or resources you would want to point out to fellow entrepreneurs in the Southeast Michigan region? Any networking groups or you know, things that they should kind of plug themselves into?
Well, certainly, I think if you are, I may have mentioned this, and I'm just looking at your sheet here. You actually write here, what was the hardest part of raising capital? I wanted to tell you it was actually getting up in the morning.
Yeah.
And everybody has to realize that. But, you know, I think one other thing that I may have forgotten to mention, we can talk about it quickly in passing, but it's important when you are not based on the coasts to really focus on building that network out. And, you know, our relationship with a company like Mucker was absolutely game-changing in what we were able to accomplish. Mm. And even if you think that you have everything figured out and there's no value that an accelerator can bring, if the value is just the relationships and that network, it's you need to really critically think about that, because at the end of the day, the world of VC is a network. And finding an angle to crack into that network is significantly more difficult if you're not located there.
Yeah, that's good. Finding an angle to crack in that network, that's great advice. Okay, very good. Well, if people want to learn more, it's pawnguru.com, correct? PAWNGURU.com.
Absolutely, pawnguru.com. And if you want to consider another way to buy or sell your used goods instead of eBay or creepy Craigslist, give us a shout out. You might be surprised as to how easy it is, but I will give a disclaimer depending on which city you're in. We have broader markets in different cities as we're building out our liquidity.
Great. Very good. All right, Jonathan, thank you. This is fantastic. And good luck figuring out your business model and getting to that next profitability point, and I'll catch you after your next round. How about that?
Absolutely. We'll be here. Thank you again for chatting today.
All right. Thank you, sir.
Take care. Bye-bye.